for doing names.
I was the teacher of the Talmud class until I left.
Rabbi Scott Fulton, the newest rabbi to join the Talmud class.
Rabbi of Congregation Rosh Arua.
I'm Hanan Harkel.
Alan Mayer.
Elaine Shatner.
Paul Glasserman.
Herbert Lupershort.
Eric Weinstein.
Vinny Alvin.
Dick Stacey.
Daniel Beller.
Ron Eisenhower.
Reed Schneider.
Henry Glantz Hernick.
Laura Rosenkopf.
Jay Palmer.
Arthur Sobel.
Dennis Lebold.
Mona Dreyer.
Gail Billy.
Elaine Abelson.
Herschel Abelson.
Ethan Horowitz.
Jennifer Martin.
Bobby Kohler.
And Barry Kohler. Hallelujah. Nice to see you all again. That's just great. Now, what we are doing, for those of you who are attending for the first time, we are studying the fourth chapter of the Tractate at Sanhedrin in the Babylonian Talmud. That is available in the Art Scroll Talmud. The Art Scroll is a full Talmud with Hebrew and English, including an English commentary. And I suggest that if you intend to come to the class, that you get a copy and either bring it with you or find a place to store it here on the shelves at your own risk. Most of them stay, but Laura told me before we can't find one. But most of them do stay. We are reading in the first volume. For those of you who were in the class last year, you'll remember that we did chapter 1. That is the first volume of Sanhedrin of the Art Scroll Talmud. And we are continuing in volume 1. Chapter 4 is also in volume 1. Okay? So it is very useful to follow along in the text. It helps to remember. And also the commentary, the English commentary that is in the Art Scroll edition of this Talmud is a wonderful commentary. It's very useful, gives you the background that you need, and it translates a lot of the classical commentaries, Rashi and the Tosafot, into English so that you can follow those classical remarks on the text itself. Now, just a very short review, since there are some of you who haven't been here before. We are reading first the Mishnah. Mishnah was edited in the year 200 CE by Rabbi Judah the Prince. And the structure of Talmud is that the Talmud is made up first of Mishnah, followed by study, a commentary on that Mishnah that is called the Gemara. So, in the fourth chapter, we began with the first Mishnah. We did a part of it last week, and we'll go through the entire Mishnah, and hopefully we'll go to the next Mishnah as well tonight. I'm beginning this year with a study of two Mishnayot, because in reading the fourth chapter, they set the background to the subject. As we saw in the first Mishnah, 32a1, page 32a1, those of you who are following in the Art Scroll text, Echad dinei mamonot ve'echad dinei nefashot. Literally, one is the law of monetary things, and one is the law of capital cases. Now what that means is that monetary law and the law that is dinei nefashot, law which can lead to a capital case. In most cases we think of that as murder, but in Jewish law it's certainly not limited to murder. It is one of the categories for which there can be a capital punishment, at least according to the Torah. You will see here one of the interesting sides of the study of dinei nefashot, of the criminal law. I say criminal law, but the definition is not exactly the same as criminal law in our legal system. I use it. That is a general translation of dinei nefashot, but it's not exact. It really means law that can lead to a capital punishment of some kind. Okay? Those two types of law, dinei mamonot, monetary law, and dinei nefashot, are alike in some ways and different in other ways. So the Mishnah begins by saying they're alike. Okay? Echad. They're the same. They're the same. They're the same, these two things. How? Bidrisha u'machakira. Both of them require, in any court proceeding, they require a procedure of cross-examination. Okay? Drisha is seeking out, and hakira is researching an issue. In our language, we would call it cross-examination. Okay? So, in both monetary law and in the capital law, in both those categories, all procedures require cross-examination. Okay? So there'll be a witness. You cannot simply have a witness. You have to cross-examine the witness. You just can't listen to what the witness says. You'll have to ask questions of the witness in order to determine the validity, the truth of what the witness is telling you. Okay? Now, it could be that he is mistaken in his observation of something, or it could be that he has malice and he is lying. I mean, there are a number of possibilities, but the court is required always to engage in cross-examination. Okay? Now, immediately following that, the Mishnah says, well, it first of all, it gave us a biblical source for this concept that the two types of law are the same. And that was in the quote here that it says, Shenemar Mishpat Echad Yelachem. One law that there shall be for you. We looked at that last time and I showed you where that was from in Leviticus 24, verse 22. It was sort of anomalous because that source itself hardly says what we're learning from it here. But we noted that fact. And those of you who have studied Talmud in the past have frequently seen that fact. The biblical verses will be used to prove something that is not necessarily the only thing you might learn out of this verse. Matter of fact, it might be brought, and it might seem totally weak in its argument. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That is the method of Talmud. Sometimes it is brought. And of course, if it is not a compelling quotation of Scripture, that in itself is revealing, because probably the law existed, and what we are doing is not discovering law, but finding biblical sources to attribute the law to. Okay? Because the law has an independent reality of and by itself. To some extent, we like, or some people will argue, that the law is always derived from Scripture. Well, very likely that's not the case. That's a convenient way to think about it, but it's probably not a correct way to think about it. Instead, that sometimes is the case. Sometimes the law is used as a way of pinning on Scripture, finding in Scripture something that is known independently from the tradition, or that is genuinely a part of what we called last week and is classically known as the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. I described to you last week the Maimonidean conception of Jewish jurisprudence. And that is that there is a written law and there is an oral law. The written law is clear. You go down, you open up the ark, and you know where the written law is. It's called the Torah. It's in five books of the Bible. That's called the written law. Well, how do we know what the written law really means? How do we know when it says you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, that it is using those terms metaphorically? And a little further on in that paragraph it says, and you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. Is that metaphoric? Not understood at all to be metaphoric, but rather you're supposed to put on tefillin. How do you know that in one line it's to be understood metaphorically, and in another line it's to be understood literally? How do you know that? Well, because we have a tradition of oral law, a tradition of interpretation. Nothing that is written can be understood without a context of interpretation. It is true in modern philosophy. We were studying some modern philosophers last year, if you remember, when we were studying modern linguistic philosophy. It is true in modern linguistic philosophy. It is true in any legal system. One of the things that courts and lawyers will always be interested in is, well, was there a context when the law was made? And does it matter whether there was a context of the law when it was made? And about that, people continue to argue to this day. Those of you who are lawyers are probably making a living doing that. Okay? No? Yes?
Before I answer, I need to talk to my lawyer.
Okay. So it says, Shenemar mishpat echad yiyelechem. There shall be one law for you, and the Talmud quotes that in this context to mean one law, namely the law of monetary law and the law of dinei nefashot, criminal law, are the same. Well, how are they the same? They are the same in drisha and chakira. Both require cross-examination. Now, no sooner does the Talmud do that, and it tells us how they are alike, then it begins and says, Ma bein dinei mamonot li dinei nefashot. Well, what is the difference between these two types of law? Now, you might have thought that it would have structured it differently, because now we are going to read 10 different ways that the two systems of law really differ from one another. Right? But this is classic Talmud. The Talmud starts you off, you started off thinking, oh, these laws must be alike, because it says, Mishpat echad yielachem, you shall have one law. So immediately you assume, oh, we have one law, I guess it's going to be the same. So it says, oh, you have one law, it's going to be the same, and you have 10 ways in which it's different. And you immediately say, what, how could it be the same? In 10 ways it could be different. That is the Talmud's way of keeping you awake, of making you interested in the subject. So you're wondering, how could this be? And that will bring you on. That's exactly the way it works.
Yes? I have a leftover question from last
week. Okay.
The one law. Could it be, though, that the one law also means that the law is for everybody? You don't have a law for the wealthy and a law for the poor, that the one law is an equalizer, even though there are differences?
You're absolutely right. It could mean that, but in this context it doesn't mean that. Now, it could mean that what you have just said is so important and so true that, as a matter of fact, there is such a concept in the law, but there are other verses to which that concept is attributed. Now, there is a parsimony to rabbinic interpretation. Namely, if this important notion that you have is said in one context, one verse, then if another verse comes and seems to say the same thing, the rabbis understand that two verses can't say exactly the same thing. They would never repeat it. But it must teach something in addition to what the other verse said. So sometimes that's obvious, sometimes it's not obvious, sometimes we know it on the basis of the oral law, sometimes it seems artificial. But whatever it is, what you said is true.
In the other place.
Okay? Okay, we go on. So we see ma bein dinei mamonot, the dinei nefashot. What is the difference between these two systems of law? Dinei mamonot bishlosha. Monetary law is judged in a court of three. Dinei nefashot b'esrim ushlosha. And the criminal law, the capital cases, are always dealt with in at least a court of 23. Maybe some cases where you need a court of 71, but generally speaking, they are dealt with in a court of 23. Now, we had already read that in the first Mishnah of the first chapter. And the reason behind those two different compositions of courts, 3 and 23, was articulated in the first Mishnah of the first chapter, so I'm not going to go over that. I briefly reviewed it last time. If you want to look into it, go back to the beginning of the tractate. Okay? But that's a difference between the two. All right? Dinei nefashot, capital cases are always tried in a court of 23 as opposed to dinei mamonot, monetary cases, which are in a court of 3. Okay, now, that's the easy one because we already saw that in the first chapter. Dinei mamonot potchin ben lizchut ben lechova. In the case of a court that is sitting to adjudicate a monetary case, you can begin either lizchut, namely to make arguments for the acquittal of the claim, or for chova, or to that show that the person is guilty. You could start either way. You could go in either direction in the case of monetary law. But in a case which could be a capital case, you must begin arguing for the acquittal of the accused. And you cannot begin arguing for the guilt of the accused. Very interesting. Okay? Now, you immediately see that the law is stacked to create, in the case of a capital case, a number of difficulties to argue in favor of the acquittal of the accused. Right? The law is stacked in favor of the accused. And we saw this in the first Mishnah, but we will see it again as we go on.
I remember the television correctly. The prosecutor goes first, is that right? So here in the English system, it's just the opposite.
Very interesting.
Who has the last word in the English system?
Well, let's wait to see what the Jewish system is first, okay? Let's see what happens here. Okay, so first, so we see so far, the opening arguments have to be for acquittal and not for the prosecution, if it is a capital case. Yes?
So who actually is doing this argument? Will we learn that later? In other words, it don't seem to be prosecutors.
Correct. You don't have lawyers. Correct. It is the judges themselves that are doing the arguing.
That would be after the evidence. After the witnesses, or at the
No, the judge. This would be even the calling of the witnesses would be witnesses first for the acquittal, as opposed to the prosecution.
Is that the presumption of innocence?
Exactly. It is not only the presumption of innocence, but the stacking of the discussion to weight that discussion. Apparently assuming that from a psychological perspective, it is to the advantage of the accused to first speak positively on the behalf of the accused.
So why in the English common system do the prosecutors go first? Because the prosecutors have the burden.
That's a good point.
Proof. So the party that has the burden, who has to,
and when they sum
in a civil case, you're the plaintiff, you go first, and you have to show the evidence by 51%, more likely than not. And in a criminal case, beyond reasonable doubt, the prosecutor has that burden. So he goes first and last.
That's right. It's summing up, they go last.
It's also difficult to defend yourself until you know exactly what you're accused of doing.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so we see now one crucial difference. Well, we have now two crucial differences. One is in the number of people on the court, and two is in the very basic procedure of how the court proceedings go. Right? Thirdly, dinei mamonot matin al pi echad ben lizchut ben lechova. In monetary law, a decision can be made either to acquit or to find guilty on the basis of one vote. One vote. All right, so we need a majority, in other words. We have a court of 3. So 2-1 is all we are looking for in monetary law. The dine nefashot, in the law that could be a law of a capital case, Matin al pi echad lischut, it can be decided for acquittal with one vote, with a majority of one vote. The Alpi Shnayim Lechova. But it has to be a majority of two in order to declare a person to be guilty. A very basic piece of the law. That in order to acquit is a simple majority, and in order to declare guilty, you need a majority of two in the decision.
So, okay. What happens in between? If you have a majority of one to convict, what do you do?
That's a good question. Then you have not convicted the person, and the question, well, you don't, that's not clear whether you've acquitted the person, because you will see coming up that in fact there are cases where we may add additional members to the court. Okay? Well, not necessarily. Stacking implies that there is a particular reason for doing it, but we may add members to the court if we can't come to a decision. Okay? That may happen.
More than 23?
More than 23.
Correct. Like double jeopardy.
Okay. Yeah, but double jeopardy, you're going to see, is going to be an issue. It's going to be an issue. You'll see, but that's somewhat different. Because you'll see, it'll come up in a moment. Dine mamonot machzirin ben lizchot ben lechova. Here it came up already. In monetary law, you can, machzirin, if you change your mind, if the judge decides that along the way that he's going in the wrong direction, or the judges decide that they're going in the wrong direction, okay, machzirin ben lizchot ben lechova, whether it is to acquit or whether it is to declare the person guilty. Dine nefashot machzirin lizchut. In a capital case, you can turn around, of course, while the discussion is going on. Somebody has made a decision and come out against. He can come out for it. He can change his mind for it. Right? The ein machzirin lechovah, but it doesn't work the other way around. If you've come out for the accused, you cannot change your mind, all right, against the accused. So again, we see it's all stacked in favor of acquittal. In favor of acquittal.
This doesn't refer to appeals. This is the same court changing its mind.
Correct. The decision has not yet been made. Exactly.
Are there a polling of the judges, and then they say yes or no, and then they
discuss?
We discussed this with the first chapter we read last year.
So yes?
No, I'm saying we have the same concept. We went through it last year.
Correct. Let's keep going. I'm just wondering whether at some point I want to read the Rashi here. Okay, we're going to start reading the Rashi with the next one. I'll show you the Rashi in just a second. Okay, going on. Dine mamonot, monetary law. Danim biyom begomrim balayla. You can begin the case in the daytime and finish it at night. Dine nefashot. Danim biyom. You can begin in the day. Begomrim bayom. You have to finish the case during the day. Let's go to the Rashi.
Same day.
You
can't go into
the
second day?
Okay.
You wait until the day.
Now, on the right side of the page, the Talmud is in the middle of the page. Immediately to the right of the Talmud. And in fact, it's not always to the right of the Talmud, but it is always on the inside border, namely near the binding of any page of the classic printing of the Talmud. Right? Here it happens to be on the right. If you look at the next page, it'll be on the left. Is the Rashi. Rashi is the commentary of the great commentator of the 11th century, 1040 to 1105, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. And Rashi's commentary is basic to any study of the Talmud. So 1040 to 1105, he's a Frenchman. He studied in the schools of the Rhineland and then taught in Troyes, where he lived. Troyes is in Champagne. And what Rashi did was that he was a vintner during the day and he wrote commentaries in the Talmud during the winter when helps us leave the vines. And Rashi's commentaries are invaluable, both in studying the Bible and in the Talmud. They are also the principal source of the pronunciation of medieval French. The French don't know how French was pronounced in the Middle Ages, because how could you know? You can't ask anybody if they'll pronounce it the way they know how to pronounce it. Only way to do it is when somebody has written French in a totally different alphabet. Rashi wrote French in the Hebrew alphabet because occasionally what he did was, in defining terms, he would give the French term. So we know the French that was used in the 11th century from Rashi. So Rashi is the best source of 11th century French, both in terms of the words that were used and pronunciation, as well as the methodologies of producing wine and champagne. Because the Talmud is full of discussions about wine, because the law, Jewish law, is also about wine. The land of Israel is, God bless the land of Israel, it's filled with vines. It's one of the basic fruits of the land. And Rashi describes in great detail really how you do these things, because he knew. So Rashi is invaluable, and I want to start looking at the Rashi here. You go now, again, it's on the right side of the Talmud text. It said, Gomrim Balayla, the Gomrim Balayla. We said, in monetary law, you can begin in the day and finish at night. Imratsu, if they want. You don't have to begin. You don't have to finish at night. But let's say the proceeding extends. We don't put a limit in monetary law. Dine nefashot gomrim bo bayom lizchut ubayom shel acharav lechova. As far as capital law goes, the law must be completed during the day, ubiyom shel acharav lechova, and you have to, for an acquittal, you can finish during the day. But if it is a decision to declare guilty, then you have to hold over the decision until the next day. You have to hold it over until the next day. Read the Rashi. Im zikuhu bayom rishon. If they declare him to be innocent on the first day, poskim et dino miyad. That's the end of it. The trial is over. The holechlo, and he goes home. Aval im lo yachlu lezakoto. But if they had been unable to acquit him, bayom rishon, on the first day, ein poskim et dino lechova, you cannot make a decision that he is guilty, ela malinin et dino, rather you have to sleep on the judgment. You have to go home and sleep on it. Ad lemachar, until the next day. Shema yimsa b'layla zechut. Lest during the night you figure out that maybe he was innocent. Okay? Beautiful law, very interesting. So the whole thing is that then, in order to have some continuity here, you have a night in between. And the purpose of that is to give the judges time in order to be able to rethink the issue in order to declare a person to be innocent. Okay? That could be, but that's not what Rashi says. Rashi emphasizes here the judges sleeping on the matter, lest they, you know, after having given it more thought, that they change their minds. Okay? Let's keep going. Lefichach, therefore, ein damim lo be'erev Shabbat v'lo be'erev Yom Tov. Therefore, we cannot have the court sit, which is a court that is sitting to judge a capital case, on Erev Shabbat, on a Friday, or on the eve of any Yom Tov. Let's go to the Rashi. Lo be'erev Shabbat, she'en yicholim legomro lemachar im yitchayev, she'en mitat bet din doche Shabbat. One is not able to complete the proceedings, the machar on the next day, which would be the Sabbath, im yitchayev, if it will be a matter of declaring him guilty, she'en mitat beit din doche Shabbat, because the actual carrying out of the capital punishment does not take precedence over the Sabbath. Does not take precedence over the Sabbath. V'lishoto yefshar. Nor can you leave him over then to Sunday. You might say, well, what's the big deal? We'll leave, you know, we'll have the Saturday in between, and then we'll continue the proceeding on a Sunday. You can't do that. Mipnei inui adin. Because that increases the pain of the person who could lose his life. Right? If he has to live with, if the decision is made, you got to get the job done. If you put it off, it simply increases rather than decreases the pain. So that you're not allowed to do.
Postponed is justice denied.
Justice postponed is justice denied. Okay? In its own way. Okay. Let's go on. We'll go on to the end of the Mishnah. Dine mamonot hatane'ot v'hatohorot matchilim min agadol. In monetary law, or as well in law concerning whether something is ritually impure or pure, there may be certain cases where the court is asked to decide on issues of ritual purity. Okay? Matchilim min agadol. You start the analysis with the principal judge. With the principal judge. I'll explain this in a moment. Dinei nefashot, but in the capital case, matchilim min atzad, you begin from the side. Right, now let's look at Rashi again. Hataharot v'hatameot im ba adam. Lishol al davar tahorot. If a person comes to the court in order to clarify an issue of ritual purity, matchilim in agadol, you begin with the chief of all of the judges, the first person who participates in questioning the witness or whoever is going to be questioned here is the key, is the highest judge. Sho'alin tchilal legadol. Legadol shebedayanim. The first person to ask questions is the judge who is the greatest of the judges. Ma hu omer badavar. and he expresses his opinion in the matter. All right, so the chief judge is the first one to express his opinion in the matter. In a capital case, you begin minatzad. Minatzad means from the side. And what you have to keep in mind here, which we will read in the next Mishnah, is the way in which the court would sit. The court would sit in a semicircle. The court would sit in a semicircle. And you'll see in the second Mishnah, we'll analyze why it is that a court sits in a semicircle. The court sits in a semicircle, and in the middle of that circle is the chief judge, is the Gadol Shebedayanim, right, the greatest of the judges. He sits in the middle. And then it goes by rank out to the side, so that on the very end is the least of the judges. And you have two ends, so you'd have two of the least judges. Okay? So in a case, which is a monetary case, you begin with the center, the chief judge. In a case of dinei nefashot, you begin with the least judges, okay? Of course, the question is why? So let's look at Rashi. Okay. Minatzat, Rashi says, from the side. Minakatanim, you begin with the least of the judges. Shema yechayevenu hagadol, if the chief judge were to declare the person guilty, the lo yirtzu lachalok al dvarav, it would be reasonably difficult for the lesser judges to dispute the statement of the chief judge. Okay?
But it's by vote. You don't need to dispute.
It doesn't matter.
It needs to be oral. It's
an oral discussion here, and in the discussion, the lesser judge could be intimidated by the greater judge, particularly in a system like this where you have people of differing ages, where you have to revere the judges because of their knowledge and their status, and that can work really seriously against the person. Well, it could work against anyone, but we're not really that worried in a case which is a monetary case because the ramifications are not that great. When we have a capital case, the ramifications can be tremendous. And therefore, we stack the procedure again in favor of acquittal by making sure that we don't let the chief judge speak first, but rather last. Goes from the least to the highest.
Yes? In my monetary case, you reduce the workload by getting the head of guy to make the decision quickly.
You would reduce the workload because probably everybody would follow him, right? But that's not necessarily good. It's not necessarily good.
That's monetary.
Correct. But we don't worry about it in a monetary case because it's not for keeps, the way a capital case is.
Or ritual purity.
Or even ritual purity. Correct. Even ritual purity is not seen as comparable to something where you could forfeit a life. Okay, let's see. Mishum lo ta'ane al riv. Oh, here he gives the biblical source, which is lo ta'ane al riv. You shall not answer someone in an argument. This refers to, in context, it means one thing, but the word riv is written in the Torah, resh bet. The way it's written in Rashi, it's resh yud bet. Riv is an argument. Okay, riv is an argument. Lo ta'ane al riv. You shall not answer someone in the argument. That's in the heat of an argument, you have to be careful about the way you conduct yourself. Okay? That's what it means in context. But since in the Torah, riv is written without a yud, it can be read as rav. Rav, which is rabbi. Okay? So there you could read it as riv, as an argument, or you could read lo ta'ane al rav. You shouldn't dispute the master. Do not dispute the master. Well, there are obviously cases where you can dispute the master. As in a case of law, if the master is wrong, or you see something that the master doesn't understand, not only can you, but you're obligated to do it. That, nonetheless, being the case, still, for psychological reasons, it's not good to put people in that position. Okay, because the lesser judge just is reluctant to strut his stuff, some of the time at least. And if that is true some of the time, a man could lose his life as a result of it, and therefore we have to structure it in a way so that he's not intimidated. Okay? Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's in this chapter or other chapter of the Talmud, there is Pesach Din and Gzar Din. And usually you don't pass Gzar Din in the same day of Pesach Din. In this case, they show that they go to the next day to in case to find him guilty. So it's not in line. I mean,
why is it not in line?
Because they go to the next day to find him guilty. That's Pesach Din, or that's the Gzar Din. The Pesach Din is to find him guilty. The
Gzar Din is to give the punishment.
To announce the punishment, okay. And it shouldn't be on the same day.
It is on the same day. When you announce the punishment, no, because both of them have to happen on the same day, and that day in a capital case has to be on the second day. Has to be on the second day, so that there is no Pesach Din, no Gzar Din, none of that happens
so
on day one.
So there's one decision and execution, basically.
You make the decision, and then you execute on the same day, correct? The decision and the execution is done in the same day.
So where in the Talmud, because I think in Israel, I think it's coming from here, that there will never be, a judge will never announce the punishment in any case on the same day of the Pesach Din.
I can't answer that because I don't know the Israeli law, so I can't say. My hunch is that it's probably a compromise between what you see here and British law, that you have something of both in there. But I don't know the British law, so I can't say for sure. Okay? Cannot answer. Okay. Any questions so far?
You don't have capital punishment to deal with.
Where?
In Israel.
You don't have capital punishment, that is true. Basically, you don't have, you have theoretically the possibility, but it's really next to impossible. Yes?
Oh, does read mean strive as well?
Strive is to argue. It's to strive. Correct. You're thinking of Brown Driver and Brakes.
Yeah.
Mark has memorized one of the great biblical dictionaries, which is called the Brown Driver and Briggs, the BDB. It was a classical dictionary of classic Hebrew, of Tanakh Hebrew, of biblical Hebrew. And bless you, Mark, you remembered it well.
Late as night.
Well, Mark now has given me the app for the BDB. So you can all do this in your spare time if you really want to do it. You'll ask us afterwards. Okay, any questions? We're good? Excellent.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir. Paul, you're on.
Is there no punishment other than death or a monetary punishment?
Yes, there is punishment other than death and monetary punishment. There is physical punishment.
And would that be treated by the capital court or by the...
Depends on the issue. Depends on the subject. It differs. It's not all the same.
But here it seems like it's either...
Here we are seeing only two kinds of law. You're right. You're absolutely. Here they are dealing only with two types of law. But you're quite right. This is not exclusive. Now, again, it's the Talmud playing a little bit of a trick on you. Because the trick is, when it said first that these two systems are the same, it really didn't mean it. And now when it says that there are 10 different 10 differences between them. Well, all of that is true, but you might have learned from that that's all there is, and there are no other possibilities, and you assume that, but that's not necessarily true either. Okay? So what it says, it means, but one shouldn't take it too far.
Okay? Why the non-sequitur at the end about who can marry...
Oh, I didn't do that. So, thank you very much. I didn't finish the Mishnah.
It seems to be out of the blue.
Well, you'll see. Hakol kasherim ladun dine mamonot. Everybody is kosher to make judgments in a matter of monetary law. The ein hakol kasherim ladun dine nefashot, but not everybody is kosher to sit on a court of dine nefashot, of capital law. Ella kohanim leviim v'yisraelim hamisiim lekohuna. Rather, it is priests, Levites, and Israelites who are allowed to marry off their daughters to Kohanim. Now, this enters a whole other area of yichus in the law, which is just another area of law, so it's not worth getting into. But notice what's happening here. In effect, Rashi makes it clear that what is being excluded is the unique case of the mamzer. According to the Torah, there is a status of birth called the mamzer, where a child is born to a union that is an illicit union according to the Torah. Right? Not according to you, not according to me, and not according to the rabbis, but according to the Torah. Okay? I'll give you one such example. A woman is married to a man. She has a liaison with another man, and that produces a child. Okay, that child is a mamzer. That child is a mamzer, according to the law. The Torah says that the mamzer is excluded from the community. Right. Now, that in itself is a whole bushel full of stuff. It's not a very modern idea, and in fact, in modern Jewish law, every effort is made to really disqualify every potential mamzer. There's a reason found why this person is not a mamzer. So that's what you do. The term mamzer, you know, is a Yiddish term.
It's an endearment term.
To you, it's an endearment term.
when I grew up, a child that did something clever or cute, we always say, he's a mamzer. Look at that mamzer.
Well, I would say that is but one possible meaning. The other is far less endearing. Far less endearing.
It was Barry's father who called him that. Your mother who said it was just the term of endearment.
That could be.
They were very sweet.
Very.
I always wanted to do that. Okay.
Could that include civil? Is another word for monetary law civil law?
Yes and no. Not identical with our civil law. Our civil law could involve cases which I don't know whether they're dine mamonot. For example, what we would call torts.
Exactly.
Okay? Torts. A tort is where you injure somebody. In Jewish law, law of torts is dine mamonot. I'm careful because I'm not sure that in American law that is also civil law.
Yes.
It is civil law? Torts are civil law? Oh, so then maybe that is a fair term. Maybe it is. Because dine mamonot involves a monetary penalty. And there's a monetary penalty included in the law of torts as well. Okay. Pick up on whoever it was that said before. Oh, Arthur, you said it was a non sequitur. Yeah. So let's talk about non sequiturs for a minute, since they're not rare in the Talmud. Okay. Why would you have such a non sequitur? There are, it's always interesting to speculate on those things. I think in terms of the context, what you are seeing is a variety of contexts in order to, again, stack the law in a certain direction, make it harder to produce a judgment. Okay? So, to my mind, that's the way it fits in the argument. I don't know that it is a case that is an important case, you know, or a common case. I really don't have a sense about that. But number one, it would serve, I think, to create another way in which we make it harder to constitute a court. Why do we make it hard to constitute a court? Because, again, it's a court that will deal with a capital case. And we don't like capital cases. And we see efforts being made to, eventually we will see efforts being made to decide that these capital cases can't possibly be prosecuted. That it's too difficult to prosecute such a case. Because there may be evidentiary problems in capital cases. Maybe a whole variety of things that make it very difficult to actually come out with a decision of death. So I think that my sense is that it's along those lines. Right? Okay. Let's get to the next Mishnah, which is on 36b3. I wanted to do this first Mishnah of the fourth chapter because I wanted you to see the way the chapter itself is clearly structured. 36B, if you're in the art school, it's 36B3. I wanted you to see the way in which the chapter itself has a long Mishnah with which it began. Much of which, once we get past the first issue in the Mishnah, is to make it difficult to convict someone of a capital crime. That is, in fact, the theme of the entire fourth chapter. As I said to those of you who were here last week, when we complete the fourth chapter, if it be during my term that I am here, or Rabbi Bolton's when he will be teaching, we're going to go then to the eighth chapter. The eighth chapter is the chapter of Ben Sorer Moreh, the child who is stubborn and rebellious, for whom, interestingly enough, the Torah also provides a death penalty. Now, of course, that seems extremely bizarre, and it is bizarre, and that's why it's so interesting to study, because you will see, as you go through it, that, in effect, this particular piece of legislation will be legislated out of existence. Okay? That is one way to deal with something that is problematic, particularly ethically problematic, but legally problematic as well. There are lots of problems with that law.
But it's in the Torah,
so it's got to be there. We got to deal with it. I won't steal the thunder of that material because it is yet to come. But that is what we see in chapter 4. That is what we will see in chapter 8. Chapter 8, one particular case, and it's a great interest because we learn a lot about child behavior and about parental behavior toward children in the 8th chapter. But here in the 4th chapter, you are beginning to see the way in which the law itself is defining itself as being structured to make it as likely as possible that a person will be acquitted and will not be declared guilty, which is not to say that we've legislated the death penalty out of existence here. It doesn't happen here. I don't know if it happens elsewhere, but it doesn't happen here. you won't see it here. It's in the Tractate of Makot. But this is the way the the chapter moves. It begins with these legal issues. Eventually, in the third Mishnah, we are going to come to another side, which will get into the heart of the matter, why it is that we are so concerned in the capital case about the death penalty. And that involves the way in which you address the witnesses. Ketzad ma'ayinim et ha'edim. That's the third Mishnah. It's actually the fourth Mishnah, an independent Mishnayot. In the Talmud, it's the third Mishnah. Ketzad ma'ayinim et ha'edim. How do you literally threaten the witnesses? In other words, how do you scare the living wits out of the witnesses in order to make them aware of the fact that somebody could die on the basis of their words?
Making case first.
Okay. So that's going to be the heart of the matter when we get to it. All of this is not preparatory to it. Okay?
I've heard anecdotally that the Sanhedrin actually never issued a decree of death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if that's correct.
Anecdotally, it is correct. Whether it is correct, I can't tell you. Because for two reasons. The discussion in the Gemara Makot shows that there are two different opinions. One opinion says that the court that convicts someone of a capital crime once in 70 years is a hanging court. Okay? And the other position is what you have just said will cause complete chaos in society. Okay? If you do not have the penalty for certain actions, then society will, in effect, people who tend to do these things will do them with impunity. Whether any of these discussions reflect reality is yet another subject. And I'm careful about the reality that is behind that, because you have to remember that when we're reading something of the second century, and we discussed this last week, and I'll say a few words about it in review now. When we are reading second century law, let's say the 200, okay, the Mishnah was edited in the year 200, who was in control in the land of Israel? The Romans. Now, the extent to which the Jews had freedom of activity as Roman subjects is not a simple subject to be clear about. They may have had a certain room to adjudicate certain things, or they may not have. And that is something that people are studying today, as they have for the last 150 years, try and clarify the difference. Last week, what I tried to point out to you, we looked last week, let me see if I can find this, I was reading to you the some of the Roman law of the 5th century BCE. It's 5th century BCE. So that's 650 years before the Mishnah. So this is not contemporaneous, and I don't mean to argue that it is. But when you see the history of Roman law, one of the things that we found in looking at Roman law was that there is not a distinction in Roman law between dine mamonot and dine nefashot, between monetary law and capital law. Okay? Rather, I'll give you the example that I read last time. One who has confessed a debt or against whom judgment has been pronounced shall have 30 days to pay it. Right? That's dine mamonot. After that, forcible seizure of his person is allowed. That's interesting. That you can forcibly seize the person. Now, I suspect that was true. Debtors' prisons were, you know, all I know about that is Charles Dickens. So it makes for wonderful novels, and I assume it reflects a reality of England in the 19th century. Okay? The creditor shall bring him before the magistrate. Unless he pays the amount of the judgment or someone in the presence of the magistrate interferes in his behalf as protector, the creditor shall take him home and fasten him in stocks or fetters. He shall fasten him with not less than 15 pounds of weight, or if he choose, with more. Okay? Now this is dinei mamonot. Dinei mamonot. If the prisoner choose, he may furnish his own food. If he does not, the creditor must give him a pound of meal daily. If he choose, he may give him more. On the third market day, let them divide his body among them. Right? This is serious business. This is serious business for not paying your creditor. For not paying your creditor. Now, what I tried to say in giving you some of this background is that we shouldn't assume that the subject of the Mishnah is to be taken for granted. That there really should be a difference between monetary law and dinei nefashot, capital law. Okay? What we know in our modern context didn't happen yesterday. It happened in a long, long time of development, both of Roman law and of Jewish law, to tell you the truth. The law of the Bible and the history of Jewish law had an impact on this, as did Roman law. But modern law, modern English law, has gone through its own changes in the last 100 years, as American law. And laws is always changing. But what the Mishnah has defined as two different areas of law isn't to be assumed to be the only way you can think about it. Right? I just wanted you to see the Roman example. So when we are looking at the Mishnayot, to some extent we are thinking of this logically in terms of our experience. Right? We're taking cases and we are thinking of them as we would react to them. So there's an element of logic here. To some extent, there are biblical verses that are crucial. We saw that in the very beginning, Mishpat Echad. Right? There's reference made to a biblical verse. To some extent, there may be another agenda as well. If what we are reading is being written and defined in a Roman context at the end of the second century, right? Part of what we are defining is defining against. This is defining the Jewish community against the Romans. Okay? And what was assumed to be proper or ethical behavior in a Roman context. So I think you have to keep all of those things in mind when we see the Mishnah.
And we also know that the Romans executed.
Oh, absolutely. The law of execution. Where do I have my big article on execution here? Wonderful article written. It's the Journal of American Academy of Religion, December 2002, volume 70, number 4, by a woman who was a postdoctoral fellow at Yale, titled Decapitation and the Discourse of Anti-Syncretism in the Babylonian Talmud. As any good academic, she's partially incomprehensible. But the first part, I think, makes the point. This is a comparative discussion of decapitation, one of my favorite subjects, in Roman law and Jewish law. Decapitate, Roman law and Jewish law. And her point, the reason that I brought this to for your interest, is the last point that I have made, she has made, Dr. Berkowitz makes this point, that in understanding the law of Sanhedrin, you must read the law of Sanhedrin as a response to Roman law. That is one of, I think she emphasizes it too much because I think that Jewish law has its own internal dynamic, which is why I've modified the notion here. But there are really several things happening at once. One is a response to Roman law. One is dealing with the facts of the case and the reality of the legal system as it existed in that time, you know, in and of itself, within itself. And the other is the Bible, and the way in which the law takes off from the Bible. Yes.
I don't understand why there should have been an objective to create or interpret a law, okay, that was different from what was to contradict Roman law, per se. I mean, I would think that the development of our law, okay, would be for the benefit of us, not let's just do something different from the other countries.
The rabbis were contemptuous of the Romans. They admired certain things about the Romans as follows. This is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. They said the Romans build wonderful bridges and aqueducts. Right? But they don't have a scintilla of sense about the importance of human life. Okay? This was the rabbi's view of the Romans. Therefore, when you come to the court, the activities of the court, they felt only contempt for the Romans. And they wanted to define themselves and make it very clear that though they were living in a Roman environment, they in no way accepted what the Romans had to say.
Did they have jurisdiction, the Jewish courts, over their...
Not clear. My guess is that they had partial jurisdiction. Because as far as I can understand the reality, it appears to me that the Romans and the Jews lived side by side. If you go to a place like Tzipori, for example, go to Tzipori in Israel. Fascinating. You see where the rabbis of the Talmud lived. Okay? You can visit this in Tzipori, which is outside of Tiberias. So you go and you see where Rabbi Judah the Prince lived, Rabbi Yochanan lived. You see, we know where their neighborhoods were. And then, within, I would say, 200 meters of where they're living is a Roman amphitheater. There the Romans did their stuff. Okay? They lived side by side. We also have houses in Tzipori, where we see and we know the influence of Roman architecture and of Roman art in mosaics. The mosaics are extraordinary mosaics, entirely according to the Roman style. Okay? So we know that there's a tremendous impact of aesthetics. At the same time, these are the same guys I'm reading here. We're reading. And we're not talking about another group of rabbis. These are the rabbis. They live next door and in those houses. Right? So these cultures lived side by side. And we still haven't figured out the extent to which they play off each other in the context. But as far as the Romans go, I don't think it's all that important for them. For the Jews, it was very important because they were not the people in power. Not that they were totally subject, but they were not in power. The Romans were. And they so strongly objected to Roman ethics.
I might have thought, that what you read, had we not discussed it, meant that on that third market day, the person could be sold into slavery and the proceeds split amongst the creditors. Because what's the significance of it? I mean, it seems as if you're depriving the creditor of the potential of getting money back if the law demands that the person simply be put to death on the third market. I mean, but we know that that's simply the only option that was available at that
point. I think what you have said is possible. I can't say, I don't really know much more than that. Yes, Dan.
I think what you said a moment ago about the rabbi's view of the Romans and their view of human life, I think is really beautiful and the important part about all of this, because you could read this, what we've been studying, as, you know, a discussion about civil and criminal procedure, the two most important subjects in law school. But, you know, and a concern really about how you go about establishing guilt or innocence, or who's liable and who's not liable in a monetary dispute, and the number of judges, and that it's all very procedural, but I think it's really about the value of human life.
Certainly.
And they're not that, you know, if you have a tradition of man created the Tselenoikim, then you're much more concerned about treating human beings in a certain way and not so much worried about guilt or innocence or things like that. And that's the contrast, I think, between the Romans and Jewish approach.
To that I say amen. Okay, it's good. Let's go on. 36b3. Okay? The Mishnah. Sanhedrin hayta kachatzi goren agula. We are now going to see the way in which the Sanhedrin would sit. Sanhedrin is referring to a Sanhedrin of 71, but the court of 23 would be the same. Okay? For whatever reason, the Mishnah is discussing the Sanhedrin, probably of 71. Okay? They would sit like a half circle of the threshing floor. A threshing floor is circular. Did you ever see, what do you call it, threshing wheel? A millstone. A millstone is, how is a millstone shaped?
Circle.
It's circular. It's circular, okay? So the threshing floor is essentially circular, all right? This is kachatzi. This is like half of that circle. It's like half of a circle. So they sit in a semicircle, and that is the way the judges are required to sit. Kedei sheyuhu ro'in ze et ze, so that they be able to see each other. A fascinating idea.
A little like Orders the Rule.
Not a small thing. You're absolutely right.
Actually, today, in Albany, the New York Court of Appeals, the judges, seven judges sit like that, in a semicircle.
Fascinating, fascinating. I've always wondered why it is that in the courts in which I've been, the judges sit in the front, in a straight line. The problem with sitting in a straight line is that the judges don't see each other. And here, it's very important for the judges to make eye contact with each other in order to see the impact of the way in which each of them reacts. So part of what is going on is the judges are seeing each other.
I think that's a bad part.
Oh, you could argue it's a bad part.
Right. You want the judges to be impartial. You don't want a young judge who can sit there and see the senior judge shake his head or frown or worse beyond an argument.
They're going to discuss the case among themselves anyway, so there's no just by looking at them they're not going to disturb their impartiality.
What
do you get out of looking at the other judges?
Body language.
Uh-huh.
But you also reinforce the hierarchy that way. For the young guy who doesn't know anything, as it were, that little guy at the end, for him to have the eyes of the elder judge on him is like Fisher, what do you know? That keeps him in line to not step beyond his knowledge.
That's one possibility. I could also imagine the opposite possibility. The opposite possibility is that the big shot's got to look at the little guy. Right? He's got to be...
The little guy's got a crack at looking directly at the eyes of the big shot.
A bigger chance to convince.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, sometimes when I'm in a lecture, let's say, and someone's saying something that's off, I'll look around me and I'll notice if other people seem to be looking, noting that something's wrong. And if the two youngest are sitting opposite roughly, they may clue each other what's going on. Even looking at the eyes the wrong way can make you pay more attention.
That's very true. Very true.
Also,
maybe?
I think the semicircle is also less intimidating to the defendant
straight line of judgment.
Go a little further. Why? How would you articulate?
Because it's more embracing.
It's more human, I think. Yeah. It's more. And when you said before, it's like Ors Arua downstairs, that's exactly why we set it up that way. Just think of churches and synagogues. How are they normally set up? Normally set up with rows facing forward. Okay? The very reason why, from the very first service of Ors Arua, we set up the room so that people would look at each other, was so that the environment would be an environment which fostered a sense of community. Community. And where it was humanizing, as opposed to just looking forward. When you're looking forward, you are sort of looking at usually a figure in the front.
It's more hierarchical.
It's very hierarchical. It's quite hierarchical when everybody looks at one person in the front.
The British Parliament, they sit opposite each other.
They sit. Yes, I've always thought.
A long room,
correct.
And they sit very close,
like
touching each other and looking at each other.
Shouldn't be together in the sense of community.
No, the opposition is in you, because there are many thousands.
To foster impartiality.
That's part of the objective of the judges. But would you object to the judges being humanized in the experience? Do you think that this is a theoretical, and they could do it? They never have to see anybody. You could do the whole thing, let's say, today on TV screens.
That's right.
You could do it on TV screens. We don't even need TV screens. What about just a written, you write everything out.
We'll do it on the internet.
Do it on the internet.
The British Parliament, by the way, they sit two sword lengths away from each other. And that was to give them a little pause before they went over the line. That's exactly, it was designed with those metrics.
Uh-huh. Fascinating. Fascinating.
I just have one more, and that is that, you know, you don't have a jury. The judges are, in essence, a jury, too.
Correct.
So they're not just making independent judgments. They're also going to be conferring in a way, too, and coming to an agreement altogether. So I think because they have that function as well, it is good that they can communicate and see each other in order to come to something.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. Let's go forward. Ushne sofrei dayanim. Two scribes. Right? You've got two court reporters. Omdim lifneihem. They stand before the judges. Echad miyamin, the echad mismol. One on the right side and one on the left side. Bekodvin divrei mechayavim v'divrei mezakim. And each of them has to write everything that they hear, the words of those who are accusing and the words of those who are defending. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shloshat, there were three judicial scribes. Echad Kotev Divrei HaMezakim, one writes the words of the one who is defending. The other one writes the words of the one who is for conviction. And the third one writes both of them, so that they have somebody to check against. So Rashi says that the reason why they one writes one and the other writes the other is that it's just too tiring. It's exhausting for people to have to do this. So in fact, you give people a break. You give people a break if they don't have to do everything. It's very intense to have to be such a court reporter. I always, one of the things that amazed me whenever I've been on a jury is to see the court reporters who are sitting there talking, the stenographers. I can't imagine how they do that job. The kind of brain it takes to be able to do that kind of work always amazes me. Just something I could never, ever do.
Is this also an indication we're talking about something theoretical?
that the fact that Rabbi Yehuda would sort of disagree about something that should be factual?
It's a good point that you make. I don't know the answer to that, because it could be that, yes, this is theoretical, and that's why you have two different points of view, because you would think that they would know. Or it could be that there were two different ways of doing it. You know, it could be that the uniformity that we take for granted in the system, particularly in a religious system, really is something that didn't exist. That in fact, in Tiberias it was done one way, in Tsiporia it was done another way, and what is being reflected here is just a variety of different ways that in fact things were done. So it's hard to say. It's really hard to say.
This brings to mind two things. First, satanic verses, and the translator decides to go off on his own, and this obviously protects against that. This is before tape recorders, where there is no archival copy. So having the redundancy is a very, very important quality control measure.
Now, very, very important.
The other thing it calls to mind, though, in a modern context, is when you do a very large clinical trial, thousands of patients, some it can be 20,000 patients, and each patient you may collect hundreds of data points on. So now we're talking about massive amounts of data. And before you crack the code, before you run the statistical analysis, you have to be sure that all of the data were actually entered accurately. It's a monumental task, sure, to make sure that no error has crept into it. So actually, one of the ways that this is done is to literally enter the data twice.
Twice. It's the same thing.
And then to compare the two data sets, looking for inconsistencies and then resolving the inconsistencies before actually beginning the final analysis. And this sounds really close to that as a quality control measure.
In accounting, very much, very much.
In accounting, there is Rishum Kaful, which you do for any charge or expense in two different categories. Double entry.
Uh-huh.
So at the end, the two
have got
size of the general ledger, whatever they should match.
Terrific. We continue. We are at the 37A1 at the top.
Barry.
Yeah,